Blog Talk Radio.
Believe not in
been humbled.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your humble hosts, Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy. We hope that everybody is doing well today, and you know what I better do? I better unmute the fellow host of this program and bring Tim on. Hi, Tim.
Well, good evening, Miss Fritzy, and how the devil are you tonight?
Doing devilishly well.
I'm very glad to hear it.
For a Monday, not too bad. I've got a big, huge feather bed down here. It's a new bed for the cat.
It's huge.
Brandy decided that she liked that bed as well. She has a big, huge bed upstairs, but she likes Freya's new feather bed, and she was kind of testing it out, and Freya's nose is a little out of joint at this point. But Freya's back, and she's lying on her brand-new feather bed, so all is well in the universe here in the Cal Fritzy world.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear it, you know, because I know that both cats and dogs can be a little possessive over their personal space. So I'm glad to hear that it's all sorted out now and we're not going to have any feline fatwas flying about.
We won't be hearing too many, meows, get out of my bed, it's mine. Not today. I hope
good
anyway.
Stuff.
But yeah, they're funny little creatures. Brandy and Freya, they're kind of joined at the hip. They're little best buddies. I think Brandy just wanted to share Freya's bed and let her know that, hey, I'm your buddy, can I sleep with you? And of course, Freya was having none of it. So there you go. That's how my day is going. How pedestrian is my life, Tim?
Oh, well, you've had an extremely pedestrian day compared to mine. But I started off my day. I thought I would start the day off nice and easy, nice and gently. I thought I would have a wash in the bathroom. Now, you might say to yourself, you know, how hard can it be? Well, not normally. Normally it's not a problem. But I'd no sooner switched the tap on than some piece of plumbing underneath the bathroom sink disconnected itself. And before you know it, there was water flying everywhere all around the bathroom. And I'm, how do I turn this off? And I was running around the house trying to remember where I last saw the stop tap to turn the water off. And by the time I eventually found the stop tap to turn the water off to the entire building, to the entire house, I had succeeded in shorting out the electrics, and it's taken me all day to get everything cleared up and get the electrics back on. And at one point I thought, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do about getting onto the show tonight, because I'm going to have no wireless, I'm going to have no electrics, I'm going to have nothing. But fortunately, it's all...
So if I had started the show and there was no fellow host there, that would have been the culprit.
Well, yes, I mean, I do have a plan B, and the plan B involves piling my laptop and all my equipment into my car and zipping off down to my local gym, because where I am, I've got this really nice gym. It's set in like a hotel complex called the Belfry. I mean, some of your listeners may know this complex because occasionally they host the Ryder Cup at the Belfry. It's set in the Midlands here. And it's a lovely, lovely place. If you're ever over in the West Midlands and you get the opportunity to come and visit, the Belfry is a wonderful place to stay. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a member of the gym. They've got this lovely cafe overlooking the swimming pool. And if you're a member, you can go in and take advantage of the Wi-Fi, which is the point I was getting round to, and I could have hopefully have hooked up in time for the show without too much trouble. So I do have a plan B for all the listeners who were sort of biting their fingernails on as I was telling that story, thinking, oh no, we could have had a Monday night without Tim, and then what would we have done? And so fortunately, none of that came to pass, and here I am.
Oh, and thank goodness you are. because, like I say, the Monday show is just not the same without you, and that you're here, and I am eternally grateful that you take your time out to be with me. I take my time out to be with you. What am I talking about? This is our show. We both take our times out to be with everybody.
Yep.
And ladies and gentlemen, we do have a topic for today and tonight, or in Mike Holt's case, this morning, because Mike will listen in archive. And so good morning, Mike, over there in Australia. But we want to talk about the Grand Mufti and the role that the Grand Mufti plays within Islam. Now, I have been doing a little bit of research. One in particular that I was thinking that we would concentrate on was the Grand Mufti and Hitler, and that his name was Haj Amin al-Husseini. But we'll get to him in a few moments. But right now, the general role of the Grand Mufti, what is their role, and what is the influence that they carry within the Islamic realm? Well, we know that the Grand Mufti is the great of expounders. He is the highest official of religious law in a Sunni or a Badi Muslim community. The Grand Mufti issues legal opinions, edicts, fatwas on interpretations of Islamic law for private clients or to assist judges in deciding cases. Now, the collected opinions of the Grand Mufti serve as a valuable source of information on the practice and the practical application of Islamic law as opposed to its abstract formulation. Now, that is very interesting. The application of Islamic law as opposed to its abstract formulation. I find that to mean they're pretty darn serious about the Sharia business, and they take it quite seriously, Tim, don't they?
Well, they do indeed, and I think it's important to remember that when you're talking about a position like the Grand Mufti, it carries a great deal of influence, and when the Grand Mufti says something, it means as much to Muslims, certainly within that country that he happens to be Grand Mufti of, because there are Grand Muftis in various Islamic countries, and they all have a large amount of influence, and it's almost as if you could almost say that the influence they have is comparable to almost like the Pope when it comes to Catholicism. Now, the Grand Mufti that we hear most about, of course, mainly because of the notorious history that he had during the Second World War and his influence with Hitler, is, as you say, is Grand Mufti Haj Amin al-Husseini. But I was looking just to get a little bit of comparison earlier today, when I eventually got the power back on. I do have to apologise, because I had intended to do a little bit more research, far more research than I'd actually done, but because we had like sparks flying around the place and general mayhem, I wasn't able to do quite as much as I wanted to. But I did have a look at a little bit about what the Grand Mufti of Syria does, and I thought that would be an interesting one to look at as a contrast, not least because Syria is in the middle of a civil war at the moment, and it's interesting to look at the kind of approach that he's taken. And having read a little bit about what he said, some of his attitudes seem to be surprisingly conciliatory for a senior Muslim cleric. We do hear a great deal about Muslim clerics who seem to spend pretty much all their time denouncing the West and denouncing Jews and Zionists and calling for Allah to destroy the whole bunch of us. And it's very tempting to think, well, maybe all Muslim clerics feel that way. Not that I'm saying they don't feel that way, but it certainly seems that some of the public pronouncements, in particular with the Grand Mufti of Syria, are not quite as inflammatory as some other Muslim clerics that we hear about in the press quite a lot. This particular Grand Mufti, who came to power, I think it was in 2005, his name is Ahmed Badreddin Hassoun. And he seems to have made quite a few movements in trying to draw together. I mean, this is probably these pronouncements that he made, I think, were before the Civil War actually got into its stride in the last couple of years. But he seemed to be doing maybe quite a bit more than other senior Muslim clerics have done to try and draw the various strands of the religious factions, not just Muslim factions, but I'm talking about trying to bring in Christians into the dialogue as well, and trying to foster a sense of brotherhood. Now, I may be doing this chap a little bit, I may be giving him a little bit too much praise, but I am looking at. I've looked at a couple of articles, and he does seem to be somewhat more conciliatory. But the point is,
mm-hmm.
he does have a.
I've noticed
the
yeah.
position of Grand Mufti does have a lot of influence, and so I think it's worth exploring some of the things that Grand Muftis in the past may have done and said, especially with Hajj in al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem during the Second World War, and. You know, doing a little bit of comparison with people with other Grand Muftis in the Islamic world today wouldn't hurt, I feel, because it's worthwhile trying to get a picture of to what extent the people in this position have influence throughout the Muslim world. And the answer is they have quite a lot of influence, not necessarily to the point where everything they say is automatically accepted by all Muslims in their country, but nevertheless. A lot of influence. So I thought I'd throw that in right at the start, because I know once we start talking about Hajj Amin al-Husseini, it's going to be quite difficult for me to keep the vitriol out of my voice, because he was an opportunist, and he took the opportunity to make life very difficult for especially for Jewish people during the Second World War, and was in a large part responsible for what happened to the Jewish communities in that time.
When we touch on that, we will certainly bring up the military arm, Hitler's one arm of the military, Hitler's military, and that Islam held a very special role in terms of the annihilation of the Jews, and we will touch on that a little later down the road. But just the Grand Mufti in general, I have always been rather confused by their influence and how influential they are. We have always discussed Islam as being a collective in which they think as a collective. There is no room for individual thought or action. You have to blindly follow. But one thing that the Mufti demands is that they are responsible for influential legal opinions, i.e. fatwas. They interpret the Sharia law. Now, the Ottoman Empire began to practice... This happened via the Ottoman Empire. It began the practice of giving official recognition and status to a single mufti above all others as the Grand Mufti. The Grand Mufti of Istanbul has since as late as the 16th century. He's come to be regarded as the head of the religious establishment. He is thus not only preeminent but bureaucratically responsible for the body of religious legal scholars, and he gave legal rulings on important state policies such as dethronement of rulers. This practice was subsequently borrowed and adapted by Egypt from the mid-19th century. From there, the concept spread to other Muslim states so that today, there are approximately 16 countries with sizable Muslim populations which give the Grand Mufti the high powers. The relationship between the Grand Mufti of any given state and the state's rulers can vary considerably, both region and by historical era. I find that fascinating, that a religion... Like, unlike the Catholic Church, Tim, we do have the Pope, and in the Anglican Church, we have one particular, the Archbishop of Canterbury, for example. but within Islam, they seem to have various people of stature that dictates the how Islam is going to impose itself within itself. And what I mean by that is that Muslims will have to follow the rulings and edicts, the legal rulings and the edicts of a Grand Mufti. I did not realize how many there were, though, and I did not even realize that there was one established in Australia, and I'm sure Mike Holt would be having conniption fits over that one.
Yes, indeed. And as you say, there's about 16 countries which have a Grand Mufti. I've mentioned the Grand Mufti of Syria. There are, I know there's one in Egypt, and I'm sure, the one in Australia, as you say. But of course, during the Ottoman Empire, I think the idea was just to have one Grand Mufti who could be responsible for all aspects of the implementation of Islamic religion throughout the entire empire. But of course, once the Ottoman Empire crumbled at the end of the First World War, I think it was recognized through the Islamic world that there was still a place for somebody to issue commands, religious fatwas, as you say. It isn't just fatwas, but to give each country a sense of how Islam should be implemented in each country. So that's why we have more than one. And as you say, it's about 16 that I'm aware of. And if anybody can list all 16 one after the other, that would be good, because I've been I've just been trying to locate a list of the current 16. Although I have lists of Grand Muftis throughout history, I don't at the moment have in front of me a list of the 16 current ones today. But I'm sure I will come across that in due course. The way in which Islam is implemented does vary within Muslim countries, largely due to the influence of the Grand Mufti. And in particular, I mentioned earlier, the Grand Mufti in Syria certainly seemed to have a slightly more conciliatory attitude towards relationships between Muslims and the Christian population in Syria in particular. But I think this was when I was reading this particular little bit of research, I think that was written before the Civil War, because, of course, right at the moment, Muslims are at the throats of Christians all through Syria, and Christians are fleeing by the thousand, those that are able to. But it wasn't always like that, and when the Grand Mufti of Syria was trying to advance his somewhat conciliatory stance, it looks as though he wasn't particularly popular. And I think his son at one point, I think he had a 22-year-old son who was assassinated only a few years ago, and that presumably was because there were people in Syria who did not like the fact that he was being more conciliatory towards Christians and other non-Muslims than they would like. So it's by no means, it might be a powerful position, but it by no means renders you immune to the kind of things that we've come to expect from the Islamic world. If you say something that Muslims, particularly radical Muslims, don't like, just being a Muslim, just being a Mufti won't necessarily protect you or your family from retribution. But having said that, I mean, if I had to choose a Grand Mufti to take with me to a desert island, then I think the Grand Mufti of Syria would probably be reasonably high on my list. Not that I'm planning
that
on going to a desert island anytime soon.
I have a list of the prominent Grand Muftis. Some of them have since been deceased, but they are, of course, Saudi Arabia. I mentioned the Ottoman Empire. I mentioned the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Syria, all these prominent muftis. I'm surprised, though, that they hold sway in Western countries and in India as well. They have muftis in Australia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. They, like I aforementioned, India. They have a Grand Mufti in Russia. They have a Grand Mufti in Turkey. Well, that's really no surprise. Istanbul, hello, and we just touched on that one. They seem to be everywhere. Now, one thing that really piqued my curiosity was the role of the Grand Mufti and that of the Imam. And the Imam, is the Imam deferential to the edicts of the Grand Mufti? And, well, of course, because he is appointed, the Imam has powers through the Grand Mufti, for example, to put forth fatwas. And the Imam is the only one who can establish a fatwa, or it can remove a fatwa. And one famous case that we're familiar with is Salman Rushdie, the writer of the Satanic Verses, in that the Ayatollah Khomeini established a fatwa. Now, that fatwa will stay forever unless he personally reverses it. And unfortunately, the Ayatollah died before he could reverse his fatwa on Salman Rushdie. But the Grand Mufti, I don't know if he can override fatwas. I know imams can establish fatwas. The Grand Mufti, though, does he override the imam? Because the imam is, that's an Islamic theology, and it denotes a believer's faith in the metaphysical aspects of Islam. I think the imam is just as considered as reverent as the Grand Mufti. Tim, what do you think about that?
Well, I haven't got a definitive answer for you on that, Kel. I would imagine that if a situation arose where a Grand Mufti could be said to represent the entire Muslim world rather than just individual countries, then he might possibly be in a position to reverse a fatwa that was given in the past. I wouldn't like to say that 100%, but it would seem to me to be a logical thing to do, because there may come a time when political considerations may mean that it's a good idea, or it would advance the Islamic world in some way if a previously issued fatwa could be reversed. Now, I can't actually think of a specific circumstance where that might be considered. You mentioned Salman Rushdie, and of course it was Ayatollah Khomeini, was it, who issued the fatwa on Salman Rushdie?
It was.
Back in 1979, I think, quite a while back. And as you say, he subsequently died without reversing that fatwa, and I'm not sure if another Grand Mufti from a different country would have sufficient authority to reverse that fatwa on his own. I suspect that may not be possible, even if it were politically desirable, which I don't think it would ever be seen as politically desirable in the Muslim world. But that's not to say that if the Muslim world, let's take a hypothetical example, if it were to reorganize itself at some point in the future and appoint a Grand Mufti who was considered to be the overall leader of the Muslim faith, taking over a Grand Mufti's role, but not just for a country, but for the entire Muslim world. That's not to say that there wouldn't be the possibility of reversing a fatwa. I'm sure that possibility would exist. Having said that, I'm not aware of precedents or legal rulings that would support or otherwise undermine the statement that I've just made. So I really do need to add that caveat. You would think that it would be possible, but only under certain circumstances, and I think the circumstances would be quite limited with the arrangement of Grand Muftis we have today. And I'm looking down the list here of Grand Muftis who we have today, and although we were saying earlier we thought there was about 16 of them, the list I have seems to be slightly larger than that. Now, I'm not going to worry too much about discrepancies in numbers.
Yeah.
And I think if we focus on the role of the Grand Mufti rather than how many there are and so on, we'll probably be better off for the purposes of this show. But from far as what
absolutely.
I can see, it's somewhere the figure is nearer 20 to 25 of Grand Muftis who are around today and who exert that kind of influence in various countries in the world. I think the role of the Grand Mufti, although it's pretty powerful, I think there are going to be certain circumstances at the moment where they would find it difficult to reverse fatwas that were issued by the likes of the example you gave, which was Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah, and he issued that fatwa on the 14th of February in 1989.
And, 89. Okay, fine. Sorry about that. I was only 10
Ayatollah
years out.
Khomeini, it would have been lifted if Rushdie had issued an apology in writing the book, The Satanic Verses, a book which I read at the time I didn't quite get, but now I totally do. But if the Supreme Leader, he said that he would have lifted the fatwa if Rushdie apologized, but he didn't quite apologize. He actually issued a very carefully worded statement in which he said he regretted profoundly the distress the publication has occasioned to the sincere followers of Islam. Living as we do in a world of many faiths, this experience has served to remind us that we must all be conscious of the sensibilities of others. So that wasn't, it was kind of a backhanded apology, and Ayatollah Khomeini, he didn't really go for that, and he didn't lift the fatwa. However, it could have been lifted. The fatwa still stands. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of Muslims running around out there looking for Salman Rushdie. We don't even know where he is. I mean, he originated from Britain, but we don't even know where he is at this point. I don't think too many Muslims, though, are going to be looking for him to fulfill the fatwa.
The thing about the Islamic world is that it is full of Muslims who take things like that extremely seriously. I mean, when I do remember when the fatwa was first issued, and it wasn't just against Salman Rushdie, it was against anybody and everybody who ever had anything to do with the publication of the Satanic Verses.
Yes, you're right, because that included him and the publishers,
Penguin Books. And yeah. I do remember there were a lot of jokes going around. We have a famous comedian up our way called Jasper Carrot, and one of his famous sayings was, "You'd be safer on a Penguin book lorry in Tehran if he was asked to draw a comparison." I mean the Penguin Publishing Company. I think they had to issue. Well, I don't know exactly what steps they took, but they had to take a lot of steps to protect their employees, and certainly maybe more than one of Salman Rushdie's translators was assassinated. I think there was a Japanese translator who was assassinated. And generally anybody who had anything to do with that book had to spend, presumably, they still have to spend a lot of time looking over their shoulders for Muslims who might come out of nowhere in order to kill them. I mean, this is a characteristic, of course, of why Islam is such a problem, because they take things so seriously. Things that you and I might well have forgotten about after 20 years, 1989, we're talking, more than 20 years, we're talking nearly quarter of a century later, there are still people out there who would, given half a chance, they would kill Salman Rushdie and anybody else who they could lay their hands on who was associated with the publication. And for those of you who still think Islam is a religion of peace, you just need to bear that in mind. It's a religion of fear, violence, terror, and intimidation. And in fact, if you want to analyze it correctly, you would say it's not actually a religion at all. It's a cult that only thrives because of fear, violence, terror and intimidation. And we ought never to forget that fact. And it's a fact I like to throw in at least once in every show that we have, Kel. I hope you don't mind if I mention it now and again to our listeners.
Absolutely.
Want
go for it.
Thinking, I mean, gosh, this guy's got a lot of nice things to say about the Grand Mufti of Syria. Maybe Islam is a religion of peace after all. I wouldn't want anybody to get that impression.
But I don't know if he's trying to build bridges or what he's trying to do, but we know that Islam has not evolved. Unlike Christianity or Judaism, Islam has not evolved. He may be a lone wolf, so to speak, because maybe he is looking for a sense of reformation.
Well,
I know that there are Muslims that are looking for reformation, Tariq Fatah in Canada, and Dr. What's his name? Jasser. Dr. Jasser. Zudi Jasser. My apologies.
Yeah.
They're both practicing Muslims. They're looking for reformation, and they are shunned by the Islamic community for their works in looking for reformation. But this also brings us back to, they're practicing Muslims. Do they defer to the Grand Mufti? Do they defer to the Imam and the Edicts? That is my concern. If they're apostates, I have, you know, I'm all for them. Tariq Fatah, I have met him at an event in Toronto. He is a wonderful man. I've read his books. He's a wonderful commentator on Sun Television News. He's a wonderful commentator on News Talk 1010 Radio Toronto. I really do admire the man, but I always have to put my guard up all the same because they are indeed Muslim. Who are they going to defer to? If they do not defer to the Grand Mufti, for example, do they have to leave the religion and thus become apostates?
That, I imagine, is always going to be a fine line for somebody like that to walk. You are right, obviously, in saying that not every Muslim has the same fervour about Islam as the most devout Muslims that cause all the problems. The trouble is, of course, that unless they actually publicly renounce the Islamic faith and say, I am no longer going to be associated with this because it's intellectually dishonest, for one thing, or for whatever other reason that they choose, they then are going to have to... Their lifestyle will have to completely change because the chances are they'll be shunned by friends and family who thought of them previously maybe as good Muslims. There is always the risk that some devout Muslim will leap out of nowhere one day and try to kill them because they have publicly said that they will leave Islam. And that may not be something that everybody wants to do. Even if you feel strongly about it, do you feel strongly about it enough to jeopardize not only yourself but maybe your family as well? Your immediate family might be in danger if somebody decides to firebomb your house or kill.
Tim, did I lose Tim? I better go back in that studio and
no,
see.
No, I'm still here. I'm still here.
Oh, okay. You cut out for a second. I thought that maybe Skippity Skype dropped you.
No, I think that might have been my problem here. I'm sorry about that if I dropped out mid-sentence. I was just to recap my last couple of sentences, I was just saying it must be difficult for people who want to make a statement about Islam and the possibility of reforming it, but they don't actually want to take the step of leaving Islam themselves because it will be very, very difficult for their friends, their close family, to the point where they might even put their close family in danger, and they think that the risk of doing that outweighs their own personal conviction that Islam is something evil that must be shunned. They would, and I mean, you were mentioning, was it Tariq Fatah that you mentioned? Was that?
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of other Muslims who I know would like to see Islam reformed. And in particular, there was a group of Muslims back in 2007, and they produced a document called the St. Petersburg Declaration. I think that's something I may have managed to mention on a show sometime before. But the St. Petersburg Declaration effectively said that we are a group of Muslims who would like to see Islam reformed, and all the violent parts of the Islamic texts that currently cause so much trouble in the world, we'd like to see them excised, and we feel that Islam could become the way they refer to it was, it could become the faith that it was always meant to be, but without the violent bits. I may be paraphrasing a little here, so bear with me. The trouble was that went down in the Islamic world like the proverbial lead balloon, and the people who signed the St. Petersburg Declaration, haven't got it up in front of me at the moment, but there were some quite prominent names there. They made very little, virtually no impact at all in the Islamic world, even though it was quite well publicised at the time. And I think there were plenty of people around the world who were hoping that these secular reformists would gain some ground amongst the so-called moderate Muslims that we hear so much about. And in fact, they got virtually no support at all. Yeah, at the time, 2007, I mean, we're only talking 6-7 years ago, people realised that there was a problem with Islam and thought they could do something constructive about it. But I think what we're starting to realise more and more is that the problems that we see in Islam, if we thought they were bad then, the intervening time has shown us that the problems are even worse than we thought. Trying to reconcile Islam with a civilized way of doing things is going to be impossible, and the only thing that we can possibly do is constrain and control it, if not actually eliminate it from Western lands. But we can't say that Muslims haven't tried, because they have tried, and they've made quite a few attempts throughout history, and the secular reformists who made up the St. Petersburg Declaration are only the latest amongst many. But it must be really hard for people who see that problem, who are within Islam but can't quite bring themselves to leave it because of, I don't know, various personal reasons.
And what I did is I put the link for the St. Petersburg Declaration in the chat room for everybody bookmark and take a look at later.
I haven't got the chat room in front of me at the moment. I don't know why, but I'm glad you did that, because I was going to ask you to do that if you haven't already done it. But you're a mind reader, Kel.
I love what they say. And let's segue a little bit, because you brought up the St. Petersburg Declaration. I thought that was brilliant. And they're mission statement is, we are secular Muslims and secular persons of Muslim societies. We are believers, doubters, and unbelievers brought together by a great struggle, not between the West and Islam, but between the free and the unfree. We affirm the inviolable freedom of the individual conscience. That's very important, people. Pay attention to that. We affirm the inviolable freedom of the individual conscience. We believe in the equality of all human persons. We insist upon the separation of religion from state and the observance of universal human rights. We find traditions of liberty, rationality, and tolerance in the rich histories of pre-Islamic and Islamic societies. These values do not belong to the West or the East. They are the common moral heritage of humankind. We seek no colonialism, racism, or so-called Islamophobia in submitting Islamic practices to criticism or condemnation where they violate human reason or right.
Yes, indeed. And it goes on to say that they call on the governments of the world to reject Sharia law, fatwa courts, clerical rule, and state-sanctioned religion in all their forms. oppose penalties for blasphemy and apostasy in accordance with Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There are also various other things that they call for, but that's a pretty important one because, of course, since 2007, Muslims have been reaffirming the value of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights. They hold it up and they say, hey, look, we've got a Declaration of Human Rights as well. The only problem is that in Article 24 or 25 of the Cairo Declaration, it says something to the effect of none of the foregoing shall have any sort of application unless it conforms with Sharia law, which kind of misses the point when it comes to a Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
That's the point that everybody misses with the Cairo Declaration. Everybody thinks, oh, isn't that fantastic? They're evolving, and this Cairo Declaration is so fantastic. They're not reading the fine print. It's kind of like when you take out a contract with your insurance company or your mortgage broker. You just sign on the dotted line without reading the fine print. And the West done that when it comes to the Cairo Declaration. And if you remember, ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, we dissected the Cairo Declaration here. Oh, I think it was about 2 months ago, Tim.
I believe so, yes. And it was quite interesting in the way that they put all these high-minded abstract ideas at the front of the Cairo Declaration, and then they topped it off at the end with that, like you described as the insurance company analogy with the small print, and said, oh, by the way, none of the foregoing applies unless it adheres to Sharia law.
Yeah.
And you know, you think, well, you might as well not have bothered with the, you know, you might just have taken the day off instead of wasting your time trying to produce the declaration. But of course, the declaration is really a masterpiece of Muslim thinking, in that they think if they just put the words together, they'll fool enough people for long enough until demographics, which is the real Muslim weapon, is allowed to flower fully and allows them to overcome the Western world just through the sheer weight of numbers of people. And I think that document was produced with that in mind, that it didn't really need to mean a great deal except to pull the wool over the eyes of gullible Westerners. And of course, there are so many gullible Westerners out there who are only too happy to be fooled by Islamic protestations that they are as civilized as everybody else. There are people, dhimmis in our own civilization, in positions of authority, who hold this sort of thing up and say, there you go, the Muslims are just as civilized as anyone else, they've got a Declaration of Human Rights. You know, how hard can it be to welcome them to the fold? And of course, being like wolves in sheep's clothing, that's exactly what Muslims want. And I think that Cairo Declaration of Human Rights was envisioned with that in mind all along. That's my personal opinion, ladies and gentlemen. Feel free to disagree with me if you wish.
Tim?
Yes.
Oh, no. Here comes that taqiya again.
Oh, no. Quick duck, everybody. It's that low-flying taqiya.
That's what I, yeah. When I was reading the Cairo Declaration, I was thinking, oh, wow, this is interesting. Maybe there is hope for reformation within Islam. And I was so excited, and I was so happy, and I'm reading it. And then I kept reading, and I absorbed what I was reading, and it's like my heart sank. I went, oh, my God, we've been duped again. I don't know if they're dhimmis or they're simply ignorant, but the Western elites, the ones that we hold in supposedly in esteem, the ones that run our countries, our nations, they're buying this. And it's like, I'm screaming at myself going, they're buying it. They're actually buying this. And
oh, yeah.
The United Nations. Oh, get out of the United Nations. And that's going to be a topic that Tim and I will cover, too, about getting out of the United Nations. Oh, my goodness.
No,
the 56 states plus the Palestine in there now, guys.
Yes, indeed. The big problem, of course, with the United Nations is you have this enormous voting bloc, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which has effectively corrupted the United Nations to the point where they are pushing and pushing and pushing to get UN Resolution 1618 fully implemented. If that ever comes about, we are going to find it very, very hard to criticize Islam or the Quran or the Prophet Muhammad or Muslims generally without it becoming a criminal offense. And I think if that were ever to happen, it would make our fight 1,000 times harder than it already is. Even without the United Nations doing its best to undermine our freedoms and in particular freedom of speech, we are still having a tough time turning back the tide of Islam. That's not to say that it can't be turned back. I'm a firm believer in the power that we have as counter-jihadists with the internet and social media and the alternative media that is springing up in terms of websites and blogs, and dare I say it, Blog Talk Radio. I think we're having much more influence than the mainstream media would like, and eventually there will be a tipping point, and I believe that tipping point will come with well within the time that we have before demographics overtake us. So take heart, ladies and gentlemen, we're not done yet. We're not the what is it they say, the opera isn't over till the fat lady sings. I'm not sure
it's
if that's a really
right.
good
it's
analogy.
Not over until the fat lady sings, and you're absolutely right about that, Tim. And I'm just looking in the chat room, and Vito Esposito, he said OIC, Organization of Islamic Cowards, and he's also right in stating that the OIC is a fraud. And I know you cannot see the chat room, Tim, but we have quite a few friends joining us here today, and that includes Bigfoot, Kath, our very own Jeff of East Anglia and EDL Radio. We have a guest in here, and I think that's my friend Eric. We have Lucha Dora, Michael Kaplan, Moving Forward, Vito Esposito, Mama Mia No Sharia, and our beloved Sweet Sue from New Mexico joining us in the studio. So I just thought I'd let you know who's here.
Well, that's tremendous, and thanks for joining us, everybody. As I say, I can't see the chat room myself, but I'm extremely gratified to know that you're all there and listening to the show tonight, and we hope you find it entertaining. We hope you find it informative, and we've got plenty more for you later on. Now, just before we go back to the original topic, Kel, of the Grand Mufti, I was talking about the reforms and the of the St. Petersburg Declaration. One of the things they were hoping to do was to actually reform education within the Islamic world, because of course part of the problem is that the intolerance and bigotry and racism and all the violence and everything that is taught against non-Muslims is perpetuated generation by generation by imams and various clerics who just brainwash each new generation of children that comes along. And if we could just break that cycle, it would just be so good. I mean, I know that they did try to do this back in, it wasn't so much like a universal thing like this St. Petersburg Declaration was appealing universally to all Muslims. But I do remember when they were talking about, I think it was the Camp David Accords or possibly the Oslo Accords between Israel and some of the other countries in the Middle East. One of the things
I believe that was the Camp David Accord. Under Bill Clinton with.
One of the things that Israel asked for, you might not think it's a great deal, but it would have been quite significant, was a cessation of the teachings that were taking place in the Palestinian areas, where they were teaching enmity against Jews from a very early age to young kids, as young as 3 or 4. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will have seen on YouTube and places like that the clip of the little girl who was being coached to say that Jews were evil. How did she know that? Because the Quran said so, and the Prophet Muhammad was a great man, and if he said the Jews were evil, that's how it was. And that's the kind of teaching that was part of the accords at that time, which were designed to try and bring peace between Israel and the Palestinians, well, the surrounding countries anyway, was that they cease and desist from that kind of teaching. And in return, Israel would give up, I can't remember if it was at that time that they said they would give up Gaza or if that came later. But the idea was that Israel would make concessions, which I think they duly did, quite substantial concessions, I believe, at the time. But they asked in return, one of the things they asked was that the traditional Jew hatred that was being taught to the younger generations would stop. They would cease and desist. And of course, Muslims being Muslims, they said, sure, we'll agree to that. And they never did. They never took any steps at all to take out any of the textbooks that taught Jew hatred or any of change any of the teachings in any way. And that was one of the things that was called on in the St. Petersburg Declaration, a reform of sectarian education, so that it would break the cycle of universal hatred towards non-Muslims in general and Jews in particular. As I say, it didn't find any real support within the Islamic world, much the same as the Camp David Accords didn't really find a great deal of support.
Oh, yeah, and my apologies. I cited Bill Clinton as being behind that when he was sitting president. Actually, the sitting president was Jimmy Carter, so my apologies to you, Tim, and the listeners.
No problem. I mean, I'm sure as we go through as we sort of jump from one topic to another within the shows, I'm sure we're going to get specific dates wrong sometimes. And what we ought to do, Kel, is we ought to offer prizes to people who phone in and say, tell us that we got a date wrong or tell us that we got a president wrong.
You know what, Tim? I have a brilliant idea. You know what we're going to do? Ladies and gentlemen, if you catch a Tim or myself maybe getting a detail mixed up or whatever, which we always ultimately correct because we're that good. But if you catch us before we correct ourselves, what you get is a coffee mug, and that is the free Birmingham One coffee mug exclusively for you. We're going to start offering prizes. There you go, Tim. I'll do it. Hey.
Yeah, now. This just shows how.
And Bigfoot just won himself a coffee mug. He said the Oslo Accords were under Clinton, he believes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was getting a little bit mixed up with the Camp David and Oslo Accords, I'm indebted to Bigfoot for correcting me. That's absolutely fine. But the principle I was making was that during these accords, the Israelis asked for, in my view, perfectly reasonably, that Jew hatred was no longer taught in Palestinian schools and to young children and so on, and that never happened. And in the same way, the reformers in St. Petersburg Declaration recognized that this was an important issue, and they put as part of their declaration a point in there that would implement reform so that intolerance and bigotry towards non-Muslims in general and Jews in particular would no longer be taught. And of course, it didn't go down very well in the Islamic world because, as we know, there's nothing more than Muslims would like more than to see the Jews pushed into the sea. And anybody who thinks that the Palestinians are interested in a two-state solution, ladies and gentlemen, you're deluding yourselves. I may as well tell you that now. You're deluding yourselves. They are not interested in peace based on a two-state solution. What they want is the destruction of Israel as it currently stands, for every Jew to be expelled, pushed into the sea is the usual phrase. I don't know what it translates to in Arabic. It probably sounds very beautiful and musical in Arabic, but that's what they want to do, push the Jews into the sea. And peace will not be found within a two-state solution. And I don't care what David Cameron or Barack Obama or any of these other, Tony Blair, for example, I don't care what they have to say on the subject. If they think that that is the basis of a solution, they are sadly mistaken. And I won't say you heard it here first, but lots of other people have made the point that I'm making. But I think it's a good idea every now and again to reinforce it. Don't you think so, Kel?
Absolutely do. Oh, hang on. Sorry, I had to hit my cough button. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, in that if there's going to be reformation within Islam, and I'm just going to switch gears slightly, if there's going to be any reformation at all, like the Camp David Accord and the Oslo Accord under the auspices of President Bill Clinton with Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, we have to have the Grand Muftis on board as well. And you were citing that Grand Mufti from Syria, and he's looking for reformation, but he's being denigrated for that. It seems that Islam has no interest in budging whatsoever. And that is something that we should be very concerned about. Tim, you also brought up a good point a little while back about the fact that the mainstream media will not cover this. When they were talking about the Cairo Declaration, they were falling all over themselves to say, oh, look what we're getting. We're getting a reformation within Islam. Isn't Islam great? Oh, it's wonderful. And, of course, I used that phraseology of not reading the fine print. And the mainstream media doesn't do that. And you touched upon, well, you know, take heart. We're here. We are the citizen journalists. We're getting the word out. We get into the details. There are so many bloggers and radio shows out there that are doing that right now.
Yes, indeed. And more every day. I hear there's another great show only tomorrow, Kel. I believe it's called, what is it now? Freedom Loving Infidels, I believe. Would I be right there, Kel?
I believe it is called Freedom Loving Infidels, and I believe that's on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, midnight, kidding, Tim, 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, and I believe there are two very irreverent hosts, and their names are Tim Burton and Cal Fritzie.
I'm certainly going to take time out to listen to that, Kel. It sounds like it's going to be a great show, so I shall set my alarm clock accordingly.
We have to thank Vito Esposito and Al for that as well. They hired us to be a part of the Radio Jihad Network team. We are so very excited to do that. We're very excited to be there, right, Tim? Oh, and tomorrow night we have a guest.
Yes,
Vlad
indeed.
Tepes, the prolific blogger, will be joining us tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, folks, right here on the Radio Jihad Network, heard right here on Blog Talk Radio. But yes. I was thinking, I think I want to switch gears on you, and I really want to concentrate on this particular Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and his role in World War II and his meeting up with Hitler. But before we do that, we also have another fantastic counter-jihadist, Tim, and that's Holger, Holger Awakens. He has a very important program coming up this Saturday evening at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And he will be joined by fellow counter-jihadist and prolific counter-jihadist expert, Gadi Edelman. I want you to take a listen. Tim and myself are going to take a bit of a moment off here for a sec, and we'll see you back here in a moment. But listen to this.
On Saturday night, January 25th, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, The Awakening on Blog Talk Radio with host Holger Awakens will finally set the record straight in regards to the so-called Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza. For far too long, Islamic propaganda and Western media dimitude has perpetuated the lie that there is a Palestinian people, that there is a land called Palestine, and that the Israeli people somehow occupy this land. This night, the 25th of January, the lie will die. Join Holger Awakens on this special night as he welcomes counterterrorism expert Gadi Adelman to discuss just how the Palestinian fantasy was created, why it has gotten traction, and what the end result has been in the entire Middle East. The Awakenings presentation of The Palestinian Myth on Saturday, January 25th at 10 p.m. Eastern. Be there and learn the truth. Be there as the evil of the Middle East is dealt a death blow.
Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen, please try to be there at the Holger Awakens this Saturday, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, heard right here on Blog Talk Radio. And Tim, actually, I have to give a shout-out to Blog Talk Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a few choice words for Blog Talk Radio at times, but they really came through for me this week. I was having an issue on my Friday show in that my tape was not loading or anything, and I thought it loaded, and it was the wrong one, and I frantically got in touch with a live coach, and her name is Kathy, and she helped me through it, and my show continued to run smoothly, and I am so forever grateful. One thing about Blog Talk Radio, they are experiencing growing pains, and there are some things that they're worked ironing out, and that's natural for internet, and that's natural for a website. That's something I can certainly understand. But one thing Blog Talk Radio does have, they have the best live coaches everywhere.
Oh, okay.
So I want to thank Kathy.
Well, that's certainly good news, Kel, because you've had a few choice words to say about Blog Talk Radio in the past, so it's good to hear that they're getting a few things right now. For ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who have never heard Kel swear on air, I can tell you that there have been times in the past when Blog Talk Radio has moved her to swear to such an extent that we've had to consider moving her to past the 9 o'clock watershed. It's been that bad on some occasions. But good, that's good news, Kel. I'm very glad to hear it.
Oh, my goodness. I was having nightmares here, and they were just so eternally gracious with their time. They stayed with me to make sure that I was back on track, and so I have to give them credit for that. Blog Talk Radio, I know I have choice words for you sometimes, but you also come through in the pinch when we need you, and we're forever grateful for that. But, Tim, I was wondering about this Grand Mufti fella in Adolf Hitler, and that is Haj Amin al-Husseini. And in 1941, he fled to Germany, and he met with Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, Joachim van Ribbentrop, and let me move my page over here a bit. It just moved off on me a bit. I'm sorry. Joachim van Ribbentrop. And he met with other Nazi leaders. He wanted to persuade them to extend the Nazis' anti-Jewish program to the Arab world. Now, the Mufti sent Hitler 15 drafts of declaration. He wanted Germany and Italy to make concerning the Middle East. One called on the two countries to declare the illegitimacy of the Jewish home in Palestine. Furthermore, they accord to Palestine and to other Arab countries the right to solve the problem of the Jewish elements in Palestine and other Arab countries in accordance with the interests of the Arabs and by the same methods that the question is now being settled by the Axis countries. Now, in November of 1941, this Mufti, he met with Hitler, who told him the Jews were his foremost enemy. The Nazi dictator rebuffed the Mufti's request for a declaration in support of the Arabs, however, telling him the time was not right. Ladies and gentlemen, pay attention. The time was not right. Now, the Mufti, he offered Hitler his thanks for the sympathy which he had always shown for the Arab and especially Palestinian cause, into which he had given clear expression in his public speeches. The Arabs were Germany's natural friends, because they had the same enemies as had Germany, namely the Jews. And Hitler replied, Germany stood for uncompromising war against the Jews. That naturally included active opposition to the Jewish national home in Palestine. Germany would furnish positive and practical aid to the Arabs involved in the same struggle. Germany's objective is solely the destruction of the Jewish element residing in the Arab sphere. In an hour, the Mufti would be the most authoritative spokesman for the Arab world. The Mufti thanked Hitler profusely. And that, of course, is Hajj Amin al-Husseini calling for the illegality. Illegality. Why was that so hard to spit out, Tim? I have no idea. I have these new teeth, and I still don't know what to do with them. But that is what the Grand Mufti wanted, declared. Hitler said, no, it's the wrong time. He never said no unequivocally. He just said, no, not right now. It's the wrong time.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm just looking at some documentation here, which ties Hajj Amin al-Husseini very closely to Hitler in that respect. And, of course, he visited concentration camps accompanied by German officials in between 1941 and 1942. In particular, Auschwitz was one of the concentration camps he visited. I assume that he must have liked what he saw, because not long after that, of course, it all kicked into high gear and Jews were starting to be shipped off there in large numbers. My browser has just jumped away from what I was reading, so I'm sorry if my reading sounds a little disjointed. But yes, he visited Auschwitz, Treblinka, and a couple of other concentration camps called Majdanek and Mauthausen. Not that I've particularly heard of these, but Auschwitz and Treblinka, of course, are well-known names. And although there's no direct documentation which ties him into sending Jews directly there, I think you can assume it was with tacit approval that the program of the Holocaust was undertaken with certainly with his knowledge, if not his actual command. So yeah, I mean, he had a very strong influence over Adolf Hitler, by the sound of it, by 1941, 1942, and...
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and Vito just brought up a very, very salient point in the chat room, and that is that the Grand Mufti gave Hitler the idea for the Yellow Star to be printed on all Jewish shirts issued by camps, but we also know that in civilian life they had to wear the Yellow Star. And Vito just tied into our opening song, 9.29. Said so,
oh, yes.
Where the infidel would have to wear special clothing. And I did not realize that the Grand Mufti was responsible for giving Hitler that inspiration, if I can quote-unquote that.
Yeah, that's a jolly good point. The actual labeling, as you say, goes back many hundreds of years previously, but that's a jolly good point that Vito Esposito introduced there, and the Yellow Star was what identified Jews in particular in civilian life, and that was even before am I right in saying this was even before the Holocaust took place? There were steps were going on in Germany to identify Jews as separate in civilian life well before the outbreak of World War One. I think I am right in saying that, aren't I? I haven't got
When Hitler was voted in because the German people saw him as some sort of economist. He was a socialist is what he was, but they also saw him as being capable of getting the trains run on time. They had no idea of his nefarious ambitions, and that he started targeting the Jewish peoples. He started targeting the Ukraine Christians. He started targeting all of these people. Let's not forget that 10 million Ukraine Christians were killed in the 1930s, and I want to thank Moving for reminding me of that. That Hitler was targeting minority groups like you wouldn't believe. He was targeting the homosexuals, the disabled, everything. A total of 11 million people died in his concentration camps. Hitler was very much in the pocket of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, and their meeting in 1941 cemented their relationship. And I put the link for that article in the chat room for everybody. So
yeah,
yes, Hitler was following 929, definitely, and the Grand Mufti was the inspiration behind that star.
That's really interesting, because one of the things you mentioned during that last sentence you were speaking was about 11 million people who died in the concentration camps. And the reason I say that's interesting was when I was being taught about the Holocaust when I was growing up, I mean, the figure that was most often quoted was 6 million Jews that were killed in during the Holocaust in the various concentration camps. I mean, 6 million... pretty damn big figure, but what I hadn't realised was that there was an even higher figure of if you include all the other people, like you mentioned, was it Ukrainian Christians and so on that were included in
that?
Oh,
yeah, and the gypsies. And Michael Kaplan in the chat room is also informing us that there were almost 20 million killed in the Holocaust altogether, whether or not they were in the actual concentration camps. But there were there were definitely killing fields, as it were. And Michael Kaplan, I am definitely going to look into that, because Michael Kaplan brings up another great point in that they may not have been in the concentration camps per se, but there were killing fields. And moving forward brings up another good point in that Stalin killed a lot of them in the Ukraine as well.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, under Stalin, I know there were tens of millions that were killed earlier than that in Stalin's reign. It's just I hadn't realised that the figure for the Holocaust as a whole was as high as 20 million. Only because the way I suppose that history was presented when I was at school was perhaps slightly skewed. We didn't have the emphasis on the full breadth of the evil that was unleashed with Hitler in particular in the Second World War. We knew, that is to say, when I was being taught at school, we knew that a lot of Jews died in concentration camps, and the figure of 6 million was one that was pretty much always mentioned when I was at school. But when you look into all the surrounding events of the Holocaust and you realize it was a figure that was much, much bigger. I mean, if you think about the figure of 20 million, that's not much less than the population of the entire United Kingdom would have been back in the 1940s. I don't know exactly what the population would have been in the UK. I'm sure I can find out, but my feeling is that it was around about 30-40 million perhaps in the 1940s, 1950s. And when you think that 20 million people died in the Holocaust, it kind of brings it home to you, because you think, you know, what did it take to exterminate what would have been the equivalent of half the population of the United Kingdom? And the answer is not very much. It only took a handful of people with the power, obviously, and with the appropriate vision and the appropriate desire to commit this evil, and very little stood in their way of exterminating so many people. And the reason it's important is we have to realise that although we've enjoyed, by and large, many decades of prosperity here in the West, many decades where we haven't had bombs falling on our heads like people did in the Second World War, that evil like this can arise very, very quickly, and under the right circumstances, before you know what's hit you, we could be in the middle of something not too dissimilar to what happened in the Second World War and the run up to the Holocaust. We should never forget that freedom, as they say, does come with a price, and that price is eternal vigilance. And only by keeping in mind the kind of things that have happened in the past, learning the lessons of history, are we going to minimize the impact of what is coming down the pike in the future.
Something else, too, is that we touched upon this earlier in the program, but in 1945, Yugoslavia, they sought to indict the Mufti as a war criminal for his role in recruiting 20,000 Muslim volunteers for the SS who participated in the killing of Jews in Croatia and Hungary. He escaped from French detention in 1946, however, and continued his fight against the Jews from Cairo and later Beirut, and he died in 1974. But the Husseini family, they continued to play a role in Palestinian affairs with Faisal Husseini, whose father was the Mufti's nephew, regarded until his death in 2001 as one of their leading spokesmen in the territories. And this is, you're right, we're on forever vigilance, it seems, Tim. It's never ending. It never seems to stop. And I like what Luchadora said in the chat room about the so-called Palestinians. If they had their way, there would be another Holocaust. And what you said earlier, they're determined to drive Israel into the sea.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just a point that I felt was worth making again. People who listen to these shows regularly may well feel that there are some points which I do, not necessarily with exactly the same wording, but I do repeat myself from time to time. It's not because I'm particularly struck with Alzheimer's or I'm losing my memory. I do know that I've said some of these things before, but I think it's important to keep it in the forefront of the minds of our listeners.
Oh,
because,
yeah, I'm a strong believer in reiteration, because reiteration, it finally drums into the minds of the people. So, Tim, absolutely, I agree with you.
Well, okay, that's good. But I mean, I just wanted to make it clear that there are, in my view, I agree with you, Kel, there are some things that are so important that if we forget about them, we're doing our listeners a disservice. We have to mention them even briefly every now and again, just to remind people why we're fighting, why we're doing these things. Because at the end of the day, we are fighting. We are in a war. We're in a way... We haven't got guns in our hands and we're not actually shooting people's heads off, but we are, in a way, on the front line of the war that is upon us. And it's a war that we didn't ask for. I, like you, I'm sure you would like nothing better than to live in peace with everybody in the world and to be able to go anywhere you wanted in the world and to feel that you were among a brotherhood of people who all felt exactly the same way as we do. And that's why I often say that the Jewish model of civilization, the Jewish Judeo-Christian model of civilization that I refer to frequently, mm-hmm. Is such a good thing, because it encourages the best that humanity has to offer. It's a good framework for the future development of humanity. And if we don't protect it, the barbarians who are at the gates, as it were, we'll see to it that we will lose this civilization and it'll be replaced by something far, far worse, which I'm referring obviously to the Islamic civilizational model, that none of us who understand the implications of the Islamic civilizational model would ever want to see that replace what we have at the moment. Our forefathers fought and died for this. They handed their freedoms down to us, and it's up to us to fight for those freedoms. And in a way, we are on the front line. We are the ones who are trying to wake up the people who would rather not listen to what we have to say, because what we have to say is a little bit scary, a little bit frightening. Some people might say it's a little bit alarmist, but we do no more than tell the truth. And when you're telling the truth, telling it once is not enough. You have to keep telling it and keep telling it until people realize that we're right.
And I agree with that. Again, like, when do I ever disagree with you, Tim? Like, you word it so well that I don't even need to rebut you on anything that you say. We I'm sure you'll think of something.
I'm sure you'll think of something, Kel. but the thing is, I don't mind if I'm wrong occasionally or if I'm mistaken occasionally. I don't mind if people correct me. And like we said earlier, you know, if somebody phones in or puts a comment in the chat room and says, oh, it wasn't 1979, it was 1989, or it wasn't Bill Clinton, it was Jimmy Carter or something like that, I'm more than happy to be corrected. I'm always happy to be corrected because I don't pretend to know everything. But I hope and believe that people understand where I'm coming from, and if I occasionally get the odd item right, I hope it doesn't detract from the overall view that I'm trying to put across and the way in which I'm trying to help people understand and make sense of all these things and help them to connect the dots in their own minds. I mean, I'm sure for a lot of people out there, they've connected some dots better than I have myself. And I would be very happy if people who realise that I'm maybe missing something crucial, I'd be very happy for them to phone in, drop a line in the chat room, even drop me a line via personal email if they like. I'm all for it because I think the sharing of knowledge is the best thing that we can bring to a show like this.
There's something else here as well, and there is a current Grand Mufti, and that is Grand Mufti Shawki Alam in Egypt. And he is talking about Egypt wanting to draft their new constitution. I don't know if this ties into that Grand Mufti in Syria, but what he said that he called on Egyptians to disregard attempts to taint the draft constitution and urged them to participate in the upcoming constitutional referendum. Now, in a conference, this is dated December 29, 2013, folks. Now, in a conference held on Sunday to recap Dar al-Ifta's year in review, Alam denied that the draft constitution, on which a referendum would be held over the 14th and 15th of January, contradicts the Islamic Sharia, reported state-run Al-Iram. Alam stressed that Dar al-Ifta never was and never will be a party to any political equation, adding that the institution will only side with Egypt's best interests. The Grand Mufti emphasized the sanctity of all Egyptian blood and the importance of stopping bloodshed. Egypt's Dar al-Ifta issued 500 Islamic fatwas in 9 different languages, though, during the year of 2013. That is what Alam announced. Now, during Sunday's conference, remember, folks, December 2013, I'm citing, during Sunday's conference, the Grand Mufti launched an initiative to establish an observatory to track and respond to Islamic fatwas that declare people infidels. The observatory, which would operate under the auspices of Dar al-Ifta, would aim at shielding people against such fatwas. The outcome of this initiative will be submitted to the Ministry of Endowments. The conference was attended by several public figures, including Presidential Media Advisor Ahmed al-Muslimini and Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesman Badr Abledati. The Egyptian Dar al-Ifta is among one of the most prominent organizations for issuing fatwas as a part of the Hanif doctrine of Islam established in 1895 globally. It is mainly responsible for drawing the line between what is religiously correct and what is prohibited for Muslims worldwide. Now, although they are recognized under one of the 4 Islamic pillars in Egypt, the fatwas issued by Dar al-Ifta are not legally binding unless the state officially adopts them. Dar al-Ifta also offers advice for legal institutions in Egypt. I find this rather interesting, Tim. I don't know if this guy is yet another reformist or if he's playing with us again.
I'm trying to see if I could find some corresponding information here. I mean, obviously, with the recent problems, with what happened in Egypt over the last couple of years, with first the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power and then being deposed by the military, the attempts by Egypt to introduce a new constitution have obviously got to meet with popular approval. And I think the people who are currently tasked with putting together this new constitution realize that most of the people there do not want to see the Muslim Brotherhood or any vestige of the Muslim Brotherhood having influence over that constitution. But that's not to say that they want to completely eliminate the Islamic influence over the constitution altogether. So my feeling is that this guy is going to have to tread a very fine line. I note from the biography that I've got up in one of the windows here that he's not actually a Sunni Muslim, which is quite interesting. He's a Sufi. Mm-hmm. Now I don't know how that's going to affect his approach to what he recommends for the constitution, but I think he's still, if they're going to produce a constitution which is going to be accepted by the majority of people in Egypt, there is still a fine line to be drawn, to be trodden, I should say, even though they've got rid of the worst of the Muslim Brotherhood influence, and they've thrown a lot of the top leaders into prison, and they've killed others, obviously. But that's not to say that, that there are a lot of people, that there aren't a lot of people in Egypt who would like for the Islamic influence to continue. I think if they tried to remove the influence of Islam altogether from the new constitution, I think they would run into a lot of problems. So while I don't know specifically about this guy, I think he's got a fine line to tread. So I'm not sure which way he's going to come down in the end, if history will judge him harshly or not when it comes to the final draft of this new constitution. But I wouldn't like to be in his position right now, trying to keep everybody happy.
I think I don't really want to delve into Middle East politics. I just found this particularly interesting in that first and foremost, he's out of Egypt. And to remind people, he is the Grand Mufti Shawki Alam, and he is proposing this in that he's also wanting to stress that people, infidels in particular, should be protected from such fatwas being issued over their heads. And that was during this conference in which he launched that initiative. He wanted an observatory to track and respond to Islamic fatwas, and in particular the ones that declare people infidels. He is aiming to shield such people against these fatwas. And Tim, you're right. He's on pretty shaky ground, and I too would not want to be in his shoes at this point, because Islam is not evolved.
There's another job application going in the bin. I can feel it now. I can just hear you crumpling the paper up as we speak. Oh, no. Grand Mufti of Egypt. No, we won't have that.
Crumpling my paper.
Yeah.
Going into the shredder.
Yeah, I mean, that's just reading a little bit more about his track record. I mean, he's known as a moderate. I mean, I know what we on this show all think of so-called moderate Muslims, i.e. they're a bit like unicorn dust in that they don't really exist. But nevertheless, he's described here as a moderate, I suppose moderate in comparison to some of the grand muftis that we've talked about on this show. Is something. And it does say that in the past he has renounced fanaticism, and he doesn't have political allegiances specifically. Now, I don't know what form his renouncing of fanaticism has taken. I'm sure we're all aware of those Muslim clerics who in the past are reported to have renounced terror and fanaticism and so on. And when you read about what they actually say, they've worded it very carefully, such as I'm sure there's more than one Muslim cleric who said in renouncing fanaticism and terror, we condemn the murder of innocents. But then they don't describe what they mean by innocence, and it actually turns out that anybody who is non-Muslim cannot be an innocent by definition, which sort of makes the whole declaration, a bit like the Cairo Declaration, it makes the whole thing pointless.
Yeah.
So I would not want to read too much into that at the moment, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. But it's just an example to say that when it comes to the fact that you've got all these Grand Muftis in different countries, and although they are the first and the primary source of religious authority, that doesn't mean they're all singing from the same hymn sheet. Now, that could be a good thing in the long run, because if they all were singing from the same hymn sheet, almost certainly that hymn sheet would be calling for the destruction of Jews, Christians, and other non-Muslims throughout the world, by whatever means possible, because that's basically the doctrine and the ideology of Islam. We know that is what it calls for. So if we've got a Grand Mufti here who is saying, well, maybe we can take a slightly less condemnatory view when it comes to non-Muslims, I suppose you could say that could only be a good thing. But I don't want to inject too much optimism, because at the end of the day, these things can change very quickly in Islamic countries, as we know. I mean, who would have thought, even, I don't know, three, four years ago, that there would be such a thing as the Arab Spring, and that there would be such chaos, turmoil, and bloodshed throughout the Middle East? Who would have thought it? Because 3 or 4 years ago, the Middle East, all right, I would never say the Middle East was completely peaceful, but in relative terms, you certainly didn't have the turmoil in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, and Syria. And yet that actually, over a very or relatively short period of time, that blew up into something far beyond the ability of the West to influence or control. Again, Barack Obama's hand in everything. I won't say too much about him now, because I don't want to give everybody listening to us dyspepsia on the show. But he thought he could influence the transition of the various leaders in the Middle East in the so-called Arab Spring, and he's just proved himself completely incompetent when it comes to foreign policy. I know, and he's not doing much better on the domestic front, but that's another story altogether that I don't want to get into on this show. But it just goes to show that it doesn't take a great deal to fan the flames in this very volatile part of the world. So when I say this Grand Mufti seems to be somewhat more moderate, and he seems to have a somewhat more conciliatory approach, I don't think we should read too much into that, because there are so many other factors that can influence the way in which politics and religion develops in these various countries.
Absolutely, I agree with that. And you brought up the Arab Spring, and that takes me back to the uprisings in Iran. I remember that vividly, and of course everybody is familiar with the shot in the heart seen around the world, and that was Neda Satani, who was a singer, and she was simply coming home, and her coach, they just pulled over and got out of the car. They didn't. She was apolitical, and she didn't know what was going on, and she saw what was going on, and she went back home, and she was talking with her affianced Caspian Macon. He was also apolitical, but they saw what was going on in Iran, and she started getting active with this movement in Iran, and she was killed for it. That was her reward for trying to bring democracy to the country of Iran.
Yes, indeed, and I suppose it's noteworthy, although I'm sure our listeners don't need reminding, that was the one country in the Middle East that Barack Hussein Obama could have made a difference. He could have intervened when those people were rising up against the Ayatollahs in Iran. He could have used his influence to make a difference, and he did nothing. He stood back and let it happen. That guy is just on the wrong side every time, and I just think that's so appalling. But like I say, I don't really want to get into the shortcomings and otherwise of Barack Hussein Obama, because it will give everybody here dyspepsia and we've got better things to do.
Yeah, dyspepsia. I love that word. I have not heard that word in a long, long time.
Yeah, that's it. So
I
when
have
we set
something.
Out, when
oh,
we set out
you know
mugs,
what? Oh my gosh, we're down to our last 20 minutes, and there's so much more material to cover. Oh my goodness, we're going to have to make this a part two. But one thing about this Grand Mufti, Shanki, my apologies. Here come those fake names again, Tim. The Grand Mufti Shawki Alam.
Ibrahim Abdul Karim Alam. How about that?
You've got the entire word, the entire name there. What I do like what he said was he pointed out that the Dar al-Ifta is actually one of the largest organizations in issuing fatwas, and that comes out of Egypt. I did not know that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the he's part of, well, let's see. He's tied in with the Al-Azhar University, isn't he? And that's part and parcel of the center of influence in Egypt. Let's see, I'm just...
I find this really interesting, though, that the Egyptian Dar al-Ifta is among one of the most prominent organizations for issuing fatwas, and that's part of the Hanif Doctrine of Islam, and that was established in 1895, and that is globally. That is the organization responsible for drawing the line between what is religiously correct and what is prohibited for Muslims worldwide. And if this guy is a reformist, well, we wish him all the luck in the world.
We do indeed. And I'm just reading here. His office, the Dar al-Ifta, which means the House of Fatwas. That's a great name for a house, isn't it? Just imagine putting that on an address on an envelope and just send it to my address, the House of Fatwas. That would be great, wouldn't it? Having to explain to people that's
you
the
know
house
what? Of... We should rename our show Dar al Infidel.
Perhaps we should, yeah. I was just saying, you were talking about how many fatwas were issued, and I think you might have mentioned about 500 in the past year at one point.
Yeah, there have been 500 Islamic fatwas in 9 different languages. They have issued them, and that was during the year of 2013 alone.
Oh, okay. All right. It's just the reference that I'm looking at actually suggests that the number of fatwas actually issued is a lot higher. About 5,000 fatwas a week are mentioned in this particular reference that are under the control of the position of Grand Mufti. Now, I don't know how you handle 5,000 fatwas a week. Just imagine, you get up, you have your cornflakes, you sit down, even if your office is in the same building as where you normally live, you finish your cornflakes, you sit down at your office, and somebody sticks a 5,000 sheets of paper on your desk and says, can you sign these before lunchtime? And you do that day in, day out for a week. You'd be able to do nothing else. So I don't know how they managed to get through 5,000 fatwas a week. It'd be beyond me. If somebody came to me and asked me to do it, I mean, I'd have to hire a couple of young lads from what they used to call youth opportunities here in the UK. I'm sure you've got something similar in Canada. And say, come and help me sign the, don't bother reading them. Hey, what about this one? This one says we've got to kill Salman Rushdie. Oh, don't bother reading that. Just sign it and let's get it out of the way. 5,000 fatwas a week,
ladies. Let's move on. I wish you could see the chat room, because Bigfoot wants to know, how do you say House of Pancakes in Arabic?
Yeah, that's it. House of Pancakes.
Luchador, Dar al Buttermilk. Kath is saying, Splat maple syrup is slimmy.
I don't know, Kel. How do we manage to turn a serious topic like this into a subject for levity? I don't know. It's terrible, really. We're trying to keep it serious, and there they are in the chat room, all trying to undermine us. Isn't it terrible, Kel? I don't know how we stand it.
The chat room calls to me. It calls to me. Allah Akaboom, Bigfoot, as our beetle says.
Okay. Okay, moving right along. Back
moving
to your
right along.
Oh, dear. Now, a little bit of levity doesn't hurt from time to time. But, yeah, he's...
Silence! Yeah. I kill you!
Oh, dear. Ahmed, the dead terrorist, strikes again.
Ahmed is running around the studio again.
Yeah, we're going to have to keep him on a leash.
Yeah, I've totally thrown you off your train of thought.
You have totally thrown me off. We've got 15 minutes to run down. I mean, what we've basically covered is the fact that the position of Grand Mufti in the various different countries is of great significance, certainly throughout the Muslim world, and it isn't like one a group of people who are all singing off the same hymn sheet. They've all got slightly different perspectives. And that could, I suppose, be a good thing ultimately, even if it helps to divide the House of Islam and to introduce some divisions and some schisms that might work to our advantage. So it's worth knowing that these differences exist. But at the end of the day, they do have to support Islam. They have to be seen to be supporting Islam by and large in the various Islamic countries. So the amount of influence that they could have that could be good for non-Muslims, I think, is necessarily going to be limited. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't, you know, be aware that these people exist and that they have these different views, and that some people are going to be less robust in enforcing the tenets of Islam that devout Muslims would want. But then those people sometimes have a price to pay, as we saw with the Grand Mufti of Syria. I mean, his 22-year-old son was assassinated. You know, which must have been a terrible thing for him, and something that came about because of his position on Islam in his role as Grand Mufti. So I guess these guys have got a big balancing act to do wherever they are.
Absolutely. We have done a pretty good job, I think, of covering the role of the Grand Mufti today. I think, though, that we might have to do a two-parter because there's a lot of material to cover here. Like Tim always says, it's called addressing the elephant in the room and taking one bite of it at a time, in that acknowledge that elephant and note that we can defeat the elephant called Islam, in that if we take one tiny episode, one tiny topic, one tiny issue, and we break it down, and Tim and myself are able to give you a little bit of homework, we can consume that elephant and shed it altogether, get rid of it. I told people in the chat room to scroll up, Tim, because I got a slide of you up there, and you're eating
right.
The elephant.
Oh, eating the elephant, yeah. Yes, that was that I think is such an apt phrase. It was something that was told to me by a lady. She was a social worker some years ago, and she's used to dealing with problems that some people find very difficult to handle. And to be fair, life isn't easy, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure you'd all agree with that. And sometimes it can seem to be overwhelming with some of the problems that people have, no matter how great or small those problems might seem to other people. Sometimes to the people involved, those problems can be overwhelming, and they can create certainly mental turmoil, to the point where you don't know how to deal with it. And the analogy of eating the elephant was one that was presented to me for when a problem seems so big and you just really don't want to deal with it because it's so overwhelming and it just seems like such an impossibility that you ever could deal with it. You have to realize that it can be dealt with if you deal with it a little bit at a time. And even if that just includes eating one mouthful a day, it's a start. And once you've got used to eating that one mouthful every day, it actually takes you less time than you might think to eat that complete elephant. And that's what we're here for, to help you eat that elephant. Because, hey, at the end of the day, Islam may seem like a big and scary thing. But like any big and scary thing, it can be tackled and it can be dealt with and it can be controlled and it can be constrained. And, all right, we may not have everybody we need in the right place with the political will to do it overnight, but just knowing that it can be done is sometimes a huge, huge boost of morale. And that's what I'd like our listeners to take away tonight, the fact that it can be defeated, it can be controlled and constrained, and the threat that we see to our civilization can be nullified and can perhaps be rolled back for 1,000 years. That would be nice. I'm not saying that we would ever.
I wish too.
I'm not saying I would ever say that it's possible to get rid of all evil out of the world altogether, because the battle between good and evil, I'm sure, will be an eternal one. There'll never be a time when there won't be evil to be fought. But one of the first steps you've got to realise is, A, we are dealing with something evil and not just something that is equivalent to our sense of goodness, as cultural relativists would have us believe. There is good and evil in the world, and we must fight that evil wherever we find it. And sometimes it may seem overwhelming because, let's face it, if it was an easy thing to do, it would have been done hundreds of years ago. But there are characteristics of Islam which make it enduring, not immortal, I might add, but enduring. And if we can just understand it and realize that it's not the big, scary thing that it presents itself to us as, it can be defeated. So I hope people can take that away tonight.
And I think that we did a wonderful job in that, ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, we offered you homework in that we were discussing the issue of the Grand Mufti. What Tim said is absolutely bang on. As usual, I cannot top him. Tim makes me look smart. But it is true in that we take issues and we dissect them one bite at a time. We're not here to overwhelm you with the broad overview of Islam, because there are so many dimensions that must be understood, and Tim is absolutely correct that we have to absolutely break it down into components, and we have to make it easy for the listeners to understand. This is one component that we're going to discuss, and we want you to research further on your own. It takes a long time to absorb some of the issues of Islam. It is such an entity. It is such a powerful entity. But you know what? Tim said earlier, with the power of the internet and with the power of our voices and armed with knowledge, we will win this war against the scourge. And Tim, we are down to our last 7 minutes. I'm going to give you the closing out talking points before I play us out.
Yes, okay. Well, just to summarize, we've been talking tonight about the role of the Grand Mufti in Islam, and how originally under the Ottoman Empire there was just one Grand Mufti who was the first and primary source of religious authority in the Islamic world, and that after the destruction of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I, Grand Muftis were appointed in quite a number of the Islamic countries. Now, some sources say there were around about 16. I've actually counted somewhere between 20 and 25 in the references that I've talked to, and that I've looked at, rather, while we've been on air tonight, and that some of those Grand Muftis are in countries that are not totally Islamic, like, for example, Australia. And those Grand Muftis don't necessarily always have the same outlook on Islam. Each of them has their own viewpoint, which can be to a greater or lesser extent influenced by their own upbringing, which sect of Islam they happen to belong to. For example, the Grand Mufti of Egypt mm-hmm. happened to be a Sufi rather than the Sunni sect, which is the most common. 80% of Muslims or thereabouts belong to the Sunni sect. But the guy in Egypt, he's a Sufi. And one might expect a Sufi to perhaps be a little bit more moderate and to renounce fanaticism. So maybe that may, in the long run, that may be a good thing. And we've already talked about the Grand Mufti of Syria, who has been reported widely to be a moderate, but he's had a price to pay for that with the assassination of his son. And, of course, we've talked about the other notorious Grand Mufti that most people have heard about, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who was very close to Hitler in World War II and who was one of the architects of the Holocaust. So I think it's good to give our listeners an overview of the role and the various people, some of the people anyway, who have played a part in what they've done with that role in various countries in the Middle East in recent times. So I hope it's been helpful.
And I think it has been. And on that note, we are going to close out the show, but I want to give you some programming notes. First and foremost, I want to remind you that you have been listening to Tim and Kel of the Red Fox Blogger. I fly solo Friday evenings at 7 p.m. I may have a guest there this Friday, but Tim and myself, we are also part of the Radio Jihad Network. We are the freedom-loving infidels, or we might be the Dar al Infidel Show. I'm just kidding. But you can hear us there tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. I also want to remind you that I am the tech producer for East Anglian EDL Radio Show, and Tim and myself and Tommy, we are the chief panelists over there, which can be heard right here on Blog Talk Radio, Thursdays, Fridays and Sundays at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. I will also be a guest tonight on Far Right No Apologies, and that is with the host Roger Dorn, in which we take up part two of Canada Healthcare versus Obamacare. I am also producer of the Roosters program, and that is look at that. What did I get here? Oh, my goodness. I got a pop-up. I'm sorry, everybody. Let me start that again. I am also a producer at not producer so much. I just kind of keep an eye on his chat room and his phone lines, but that is with Rooster of Outcry Radio, online radio, which you can hear Saturdays at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So, yes, this little Mad Fox is all over the map, but on behalf of Tim and myself, I swear, you guys, thank you so very much for being here. We will be back next week, and we will be back tomorrow evening on the Radio Jihad Network with another program, and we hope to educate you. Right, Tim?
Indeed. Yes, indeed. And if anybody in the meantime would like to drop a line to either myself or Kel, you'll find our details on the website. And you are most welcome. Anybody who writes to me, I will certainly reply within the day. And I'm very happy to accommodate anybody with any questions whatsoever. And also,
yep.
One final word is if you've been following my case in the local, well, not in the local press, but certainly on various websites, my upcoming battle with Fiaz Mughal of Tell Mama UK, and you'd like to contribute to my legal defence fund, Kel's got a link there as well that you can help with on that.
Absolutely. And you know what? What I'll do is I'm going to put that link in our show highlights, and the archive listeners, they'll get that. But you can go to this site right here, and that is, where is it? It ran away from me again. I really do hate these pop-ups that I get. It drives me crazy. But libertygb.org will get you there.
Yep.
And on the right side of the page, there are two donate buttons. Donate to Liberty GB so that they can file their papers to run federally. And below that, there is a donate button to help Tim Burton defeat the scourge that is taking him unjustly to court. This is out of pocket for Tim. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be discussing this more and more in the future as February 18th, the day that Tim has to attend his, what I call the tribunal, comes up. But Tim, we're out of here. That lady is speaking in my ear.
Okay. That's great. Okay. And we'll see you all. Thanks for joining us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll see you all again soon. And I'll see you tomorrow, Kel. So you take care of yourself and have a lovely evening.
Thanks, Tim. Same with you. Once again, always a pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us. Have a great evening. We'll see you at Vito's Place in an hour. And remember, it is mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity.
Stop the insanity. Good night, Kel.
Better believe it. Good night, Tim.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله